Welcome to How to Save Your Life. How to Save Your Life is produced with the assistance of the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Your host is Dr. Philip Stieg, Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery and Neurosurgeon-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital.
Welcome to How to Save Your Life. I'm your host, Dr. Philip Stieg, and this evening we are going to discuss sleep disorders. How much sleep do you need? Do you awaken often during sleep? Do you have trouble breathing or snoring too much while asleep? What might these symptoms mean? Do you need a sleeping pill, and which one is the best? The answer to these questions and more will be discussed during our interview with Dr. Charles Pollack, an international expert on sleep disorders. Hello, and welcome to How to Save Your Life. I'm your host, Dr. Philip Stieg, and today we are going to be talking about a very distinct problem in many of our lives, sleep disorders. It is my pleasure and honor to have Dr. Charles Pollack, an internationally acclaimed expert on sleep disorders. He is professor of clinical neurology at Weill Medical College of Cornell University and director of the Center for Sleep Medicine at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Dr. Pollack, thank you for being with us today.
Hello.
So, tell us, how much sleep do we really need?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. We've actually studied that issue several years ago. And it turns out that the amount of sleep we need differs depending on age. Middle-aged people in their 40s, 30s, perhaps, require the proverbial 7-8 hours of sleep. Children require much more, as any mother will tell you, and it can be as much as 10-11 hours, and infants even more than that. Older people, it turns out, require less sleep, so that a 60-year-old, 70-year-old may only require 6-7 hours of 6 hours of sleep, or 6 1/2 hours of sleep, usually not as much as 7.
And that's pretty uniform. I mean,
it's the samples that we studied were not huge, so I can't say that that's representative of the entire human race, but it appears to be more or less true, and it also predicts a lot of things about sleep. For example, many older people spend much more time in bed, closer to 8 hours often, because they've read that, you know, you need 8 hours
sleeping.
But they're not sleeping.
Yeah.
But it's still, it's destructive to sleep to spend that much time in bed, because you tend to doze on and off rather than sleeping continuously throughout the night. And then they complain that they can't stay asleep. They keep waking up. And why do I feel this way in the morning when I get up? That's often blamed on sleeplessness.
All right. So we'll probably get into that a little bit later. Are there any differences in terms of ethnic groups and societies?
No important differences that we know of.
So Europeans don't need more or less sleep? No. So how do we explain these individuals that seem to survive and thrive on 2 hours sleep?
Well, there are individual differences. I mean, there are short sleepers, people who need much less than the average amount of sleep, who may only need, say, 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night.
And do we know why?
We don't know why. And we also don't know why the opposite exists, why there are long sleepers, people who seem to require 9 or 10 hours of sleep and can't get along on less.
Is that something you can train yourself? Say, for example, you know, you've got a terribly busy period in your life and you only have time for 2 hours sleep or 3 hours sleep. Could you start training yourself?
I don't think so. And I say that because we don't really, our concept of sleep need is that it is a biologically determined and not a matter of choice or of learning.
So each one of our bodies has a genetic code that tells us we need...
Perhaps genetic. Perhaps we're not sure about that. Mm-hmm. but I don't think that it's possible. There are people who get along on fewer hours of sleep, certainly. There are famous people who have gotten along on only a few hours a night. It doesn't mean that they got enough sleep.
Yeah.
I mean that they weren't having symptoms as a result of insufficient sleep.
Yeah.
But at least they've gotten into the habit of spending as a little...
Well, I'll be honest. When I was getting my PhD, I went through a phase where I was incredibly busy, and what I tried to do was transcendental meditation for an hour or two and then get by on less sleep. I actually did it. You know, what I don't know is whether I was demonstrating the signs and symptoms of sleep deprivation at that time.
Well, it's possible.
Does meditation work?
Yeah, well, it certainly works for some things. I mean, certainly it's a good way to relax, to learn to relax. But there's no substitute for sleep, as far as we know. And it's possible that when you thought you were meditating, you were really asleep, for at least part of the time.
Sure.
It's possible to go in and out of sleep quickly,
mm-hmm.
without realizing that you've been asleep.
So let's talk a little bit about the environment and sleep. I mean, how important, you can't turn on 1010 radio and not hear about the duck's bed or something like that. How important are pillows, mattresses, darkness, background noise?
Well, what's important is that the environment has to be conducive to sleep. That means the room has to be dark, reasonably dark. It has to be reasonably quiet. The bed has to be reasonably comfortable. And you know, there are people who, when there used to be L's in New York, elevated trains, people slept next to the train and apparently got a reasonable night of sleep, although I'm sure it was disturbed. But there's a limited amount of influence that the environment plays. We shouldn't make the mistake, though, of reasoning that because noise and the like is disturbing to sleep, that doing the opposite is necessarily beneficial for sleep. So you can only make the environment so quiet before it loses any further influence, or a bed only so comfortable before it loses any
influence. So the general message is... everything within reason. I mean, there isn't the perfect bed, the perfect pillow, and the perfect environment.
I doubt it. And I doubt that these newer bed designs will improve your sleep if you're sleeping reasonably well to start with.
So one of the things you suggested was the concept of a cat nap. You said, like, when I was meditating, I may have actually been sleeping, and that's beneficial.
Yeah.
Do cat naps work?
Well, they're sleep. I mean, and they're perfectly normal sleep. There's nothing really very different about it, except that they're shorter, of course. They work in the sense that being asleep, they have a refreshing property. You wake up sometimes feeling much better than when you went to sleep. There are people for whom that is almost a magic elixir. Those people have a disorder called narcolepsy. And they characteristically sleep for 15, 20 minutes and wake up feeling as if they've slept the whole night. Very refreshing.
So the short little nap can be beneficial, and it allows you to carry on your function.
Yes. The problem with napping, however, is that people who make a habit of it rarely do so at the same time every day. And so it introduces an irregularity into their sleep-wake cycle, mm-hmm. which makes
that's an important aspect.
Exactly, which makes their sleep at night that much less predictable. So they may go to bed and find that they can't fall asleep, and then remember, oh gee, that nap I took 3 hours ago or 2 hours ago, that must be responsible, and you'd be right.
So a cat nap would work if you had a cat nap at the same time every day.
Yeah, and if you compensate by reducing the amount of time that you try spending asleep at night. So you have to reduce your expectations.
Okay. So one of the things we can't get away from, or I certainly, maybe it's because I'm always looking for things like this, but when we go up to the drugstore counter and look at the magazine, there are these things about the importance of sleep and the segments of sleep. Well, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Stages.
Stages of sleep. But, well, what are they? What's important?
We know that there are different kinds of sleep. There are called slow wave sleep and REM sleep. And
REM stands for rapid eye movement sleep,
exactly.
So you can tell when somebody's in that phase, their eyes are jerking around?
Yes, yeah. You can actually see it in your spouse.
So as a spouse, not to be worried about it when your right. mate's eyes start jerking?
Or your pet cat or dog
really?
As well, because it's universal among mammals.
Mm-hmm.
That's REM sleep. But REM sleep doesn't have any specific restorative powers. There's nothing that makes it a better form of sleep than non-REM sleep, which, in fact, can be deeper in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Do you need, before you were referring to this, do you need to go through each one of these stages of sleep in order to wake up rested, or can you just have REM and wake up and go?
Well, that's a complicated issue. As we go to sleep at night, we tend to fall into what's called non-REM sleep or slow-wave sleep. And that becomes deeper and deeper as time progresses. And then we go into the first REM sleep period, which is usually brief. And then we go through non-REM again and then REM again and so on. We have four or five of these cycles of REM and non-REM sleep every night.
So I, as a patient, I don't have to worry. Again, these magazines are misleading. They suggest that you have to have so many segments. I don't have to worry about that?
Well, it's not something you can control in any case. I mean, how you sleep...
By sleeping longer, though, you go through all the phases.
That's true. I mean, and that's what matters, is how much time you spend in bed trying to sleep.
So, being a person who's chronically sleep-deprived, how do I know that I'm not getting enough sleep? Or won't I? And everyone else around me will.
By how you feel. And most people who are sleep-deprived crash on the weekends. They sleep late, if they have the opportunity, on Saturday and Sunday. And that gets them back to some kind of reasonable average.
Does that work? You can catch up?
Well, it does work in the sense that you do catch up. But there's a price to pay for that, and that is that during the week, which is when you need the sleep, is when you're not getting it.
Mm-hmm. And the signs of that, are people more irritable if they're not sleeping enough? Do you have a shorter temper? Do you perform less well on the job? Are there certain tasks?
All of those things.
All those things are true, huh?
All the things that you experience when you're short of sleep and which you feel are very uncomfortable are the consequences of not sleeping. Irritability and depression sometimes, but irritability for sure, and sleepiness.
So, again, if you watch TV a fair amount, you'll see a number of advertisements now for sleeping pills. Do you find that in your business, being a sleep specialist, many patients come to you already on a sleeping pill that's been self-prescribed?
Pretty common, yes. Many patients have already been put on a sleeping pill to take on an as-needed basis often, not on a regular nightly basis. And sometimes people swear by them, and sometimes they complain that they're useless. And I can believe both versions of the truth.
We'll follow up on that. Please stay with us. We're going to have to take a short break. Do you need a sleeping pill? How do you know what pill is best for you? Do you need a sleep specialist? And what is sleep apnea? We'll address those questions and more in the next segment. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, your host, and I'm speaking with Dr. Charles Pollack, the director of the Center for Sleep Medicine at New York Presbyterian Hospital and a professor of neurology at Weill Medical College, Cornell University. When we left, we wanted to talk more about sleep disorders and what is the most common disorder for which you would see a patient?
Oh, undoubtedly sleep apnea.
What does that mean?
It means, the word apnea means to be without breath. And what happens during sleep in these patients is that the breathing becomes interrupted by an obstruction that occurs in the back of the throat, essentially.
Does the patient notice it, or does somebody, their mate, their family member notice
it? It can be either one. The most common symptom of sleep apnea is snoring, especially loud snoring. The type of snoring that drives other people batty. You know, they have trouble sleeping in the same room because it's so loud.
Well, before we drive you batty, everybody who snores, should they be calling a sleep specialist?
Well, the answer is strictly no, because snoring is very common without necessarily meaning that a person has sleep apnea. On the other hand, it is so common to have sleep apnea that I'm tempted to say almost everyone that is a loud snorer should be checked out.
Is sleep apnea, the shortness of breath during sleep, is it a genetic disorder, or as you said, it's a mechanical obstruction?
It's a mechanical obstruction that occurs in the back of the throat, which is formed by the tongue, which prolapses, and the soft palate and other tissues that are in that neighborhood.
So basically the tongue falls back into the back of your throat?
Yes, and it meets the palate.
Mm-hmm. So is it a positional kind of thing? So for a person who sleeps on their back?
It's partly positional. In people that snore, they always snore louder when they're lying on their back. Mm-hmm. Everyone has noticed that. But if the snoring goes away when they turn to their side, then it usually means that apnea is not as serious a problem. It doesn't always go away when a person turns to a side. In fact,
so if it does, they probably don't need to come and see you.
They may not. That's right.
And do they usually come to you first, or since you're talking about, you know, like the tonsil area of the back of your tongue, are they going to go see an ear, nose, and throat doctor
first?
That's
very common, and many of our patients are referred by ear, nose, and throat specialists, as well as pulmonary medicine specialists.
Now, I noticed just this past week I got my physical, and my internist looked in my mouth and he said, "You don't have sleep apnea." What was he looking for?
There's a crowded appearance of the pharynx, the oral pharynx, in people that have sleep apnea. There's narrowing, and the space, the posterior pharyngeal space is
smaller. So this is the back of your throat, your back of your mouth area.
Yeah.
So how about, does this affect children as much as
yes,
adults?
Yes, absolutely. Children are some of the most severe cases. These are children that have big tonsils and adenoids as a rule.
So back in the 50s and 60s when we were kids and they used to take all of our tonsils out, do you think they were actually treating sleep apnea?
Yes, exactly.
And so now we're not taking the tonsils out. Not as much,
that's right.
Are you seeing more sleep apnea because of it?
I don't know that we're seeing more, but we certainly now know that that's an important consideration in deciding whether a child should have his tonsils out.
So if a parent sees their child or a mate sees their mate snoring, are there any signs that they turn blue?
Usually,
are they more difficult to arouse?
Usually not. But they can be choking or gasping in their sleep.
And that's what, obviously then they're going to hopefully seek medical attention.
Hopefully, yes.
Okay. Now, what's the first thing you would do, or the ear, nose, and throat doctor? What can the patient expect?
Well, if he comes to us, the first thing he can expect, besides a physical exam, to look at his throat and tongue and jaw and size, because that plays a role also, is to have a sleep recording, a diagnostic sleep recording, in which he's asked to sleep overnight in the hospital for one night.
So what happens there? It's like checking into a hotel?
Well, we ideally would like it to seem like that, but, you know, hotel rooms are a little fancier as a rule. But what happens is that he's shown to a private room, and a number of electrodes, devices to record brainwave activity and breathing activity, are attached to his body, to his scalp and face and
those wires,
chest.
Okay.
And so he's wired up, and
nothing painful.
Nothing painful, that's right. It's not invasive. And while he's wondering how's he going to sleep with all this stuff, he falls asleep.
Okay.
Because it isn't painful, that's right. And while he's sleeping, we monitor his breathing and his sleep
through
the night.
People are listening to this, and they're wondering, gee, you know, I snore a lot. Maybe I have sleep apnea. I'd like to be evaluated. Does insurance cover this kind of thing?
Yes, generally speaking. Most insurance plans cover it.
Okay, so it's easily evaluated. And the information you then get from this watching the person sleep, and is it 8 hours of sleep, or do you watch a cat nap?
Well, whatever amount of sleep it is, a person sleeps. Certainly they're given the opportunity to sleep all night. They can get up, go to the bathroom if they have to, and then come back to bed. And the wires are disconnected and reconnected when he comes back to bed. So that's not a problem. And in the morning, everything is removed, and he can leave.
And what are you looking for in this recording?
We're looking for the number of times that his breathing becomes disrupted during sleep, and what happens to sleep, what if the effect is on sleep. And the usual effect is that whenever this kind of obstruction occurs, it wakes the person up, at least briefly.
So you referred to sleep apnea as a shortness of breath.
I wouldn't call it that. It's actually a cessation of airflow.
It's loss of oxygen to the body.
Right.
Can that ever be harmful? Could someone die from this?
Absolutely, but not in the way you think, or that the people might fear. These apneas, these episodes where breathing stops, result in interruption of sleep, an arousal from sleep, and then the person returns to sleep without ever remembering in the morning that they've been awakened. And this can happen more, not just dozens of times, but even hundreds of times.
So the loss of oxygen actually wakes them up. So where is the danger?
Well, the danger is the following. Every time that happens, it puts stress on the artery that connects the heart to the lung, the pulmonary artery. Pressure rises, and if that happens often enough, the pressure can become fixed, called pulmonary hypertension, and that in turn can result in heart disease, right heart disease.
Okay.
And if
so, it's not an acute cause for dying.
It develops over a period of many months or even years, but it can result in not only heart disease but hypertension, high blood pressure.
Okay. The reason I bring this up, I just didn't want people calling the doctors worried that, you know, I've got sleep apnea now, I've got to worry about dying too. It's more of a slow problem if they have the diagnosis. So once you make the diagnosis, is it surgical treatment, medical treatment? What are the options?
Well, there have been many treatments proposed for sleep apnea, but by far the most effective is nasal CPAP. And
CPAP stands for?
For continuous positive airway pressure, CPAP.
Okay.
And this is a mask that is worn over the nose. It's held in place with some straps, and it's connected to a machine which pressurizes the air that the person is breathing during the night.
And they have to wear it all night?
Yeah, they wear it all night, and that the pressure keeps the throat from closing and prevents these apneas from developing.
Now, as we were talking about during the break, I've seen a rash of these CPAP machines. Is it something that we're just better at diagnosing? Is it more common now?
Yeah, I think it's generally, the public has become generally aware of the existence of this so-called snoring disease and is more inclined to seek medical attention if they do have symptoms. The other major symptom of sleep apnea, which I didn't mention, besides the snoring and waking up gasping or choking, is sleepiness in the daytime. Mm-hmm. And these people become awfully sleepy in the daytime as a result of the frequent interruptions of sleep, the frequent arousals during the night.
And that gets back to not having the appropriate segments of sleep?
Right. Well, the continuity of sleep is really what's disturbed. And these are some of the sleepiest patients that you'll ever encounter.
Let me ask you a practical question. Again, having seen a number of these devices, they're a practical thing. They're something the patient has to use if they want to get decent sleep.
Right.
But they certainly look like they get in the way. I mean, how does it affect marriages?
Well, beautifully. I mean, spouses who have been listening to their husbands, and usually, by the way, it's usually a man that has this disorder, and his wife is
usually
the spouse.
All right, we'll get back into that. Okay.
Although it can occur the other way around, too. For the first time, it has peace and quiet, because the machine, the CPAP machine, makes hardly any noise at all. And so there,
contrary to my opinion, it actually is a positive encounter.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, by getting rid of snoring. And, of course, you know, if the couple wants to have marital relations and all that, you do it before putting on the CPAP. You only have to wear it while you're sleeping.
So the good news is people should see this as a positive thing in
their
lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, you said earlier it affects men more than women?
Yes.
Why is that?
We don't know. But presumably it's hormonal differences which translate into differences in the upper airway. We know that men and women's voices are different, for example, and it's because of the anatomy being different.
Is it true or is it a myth that this is somehow related to obesity?
Yes. No, it's absolutely true. And obesity is a common factor. It's not necessary. Even non-obese patients occasionally develop sleep apnea. And even women who are non-obese can develop it. I mean, there's no rules about, no absolute rules.
But the more common is
a... The most common is a middle-aged male who's overweight and who snores loudly and is sleepy. I mean, that's the picture of the patient with obstructive sleep apnea.
So the first order of treatment, then, is putting them on one of these CPAP machines.
CPAP, which is...
And that works 9 out of 10 times?
More than 9 out of 10. I mean, it's almost always effective.
Okay. Does a patient ever go on to any other kind of therapy?
Hardly ever in our hands. I mean, we've found that surgery has been tried by many people. And
what surgery would they have?
Surgery in the back of the throat. They do an operation called the uvulopalatopharyngoplasty, which means removing the...
In English.
Yeah, removing the... the uvula, which is the thing that hangs down at the back of your throat, you know, and shortening the palate and making more space.
So
back
rather
there.
Extensive surgery. Do you find a lot of people have had their noses operated on for snoring before they get to you?
But you know, that's all pretty useless. They usually, if it does work, it works for just a short period of time, and then the patient is back after a few months.
So is that a common mistake, though? Patient goes and sees a plastic surgeon, an ear, nose, and throat doctor, says, I'm snoring, and they get these surgical interventions when in reality what they've got is sleep apnea and they should be seeing you.
Yes.
So how do we get that word to these people? They should avoid doing that and put on a CPAP.
Yeah, I mean, the knowledge is now much more widespread, especially among physicians, that's the way to go. And I think we've played some role in that.
So all in all, we basically not cured, but we have the appropriate and an excellent treatment for this sleep apnea.
That's a good way to put it.
Let's just switch on to something, insomnia. You know, again, it was funny today. I was talking with someone about not getting sleep and they are already buying something over the counter because they are very anxious about it. Do you find that when you see somebody for insomnia that they've done a lot of self-medicating?
Sure. People self-medicate or they're medicated by their physicians. They've demanded medications. So they won't settle for anything less than a medication. Sometimes they've been on 3 or 4 or 5 different medications.
So let me ask you this. I mean, in your experience, I'm putting you a little bit on the hot seat, but I mean, do you think most internists and family practitioners take sleep disorders seriously and are treating them properly?
Well, increasingly they have been. I mean, there are years ago, I remember, that I would have said no to that question. But nowadays, I think most people take it pretty seriously, yes.
So is insomnia treated best with a sleeping pill?
No. The answer is no. I mean, it's like taking, is abdominal pain treated best with a
painkiller?
With a painkiller or an antacid or something like that. You know, it depends on what's causing it.
Okay.
And insomnia is
so what,
different.
I mean, what is insomnia? I mean,
it doesn't really have any specific meaning as a disease. It isn't a disease as such. It means difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep or both.
Okay. Is there a technical description meaning that if you get less than 2 hours sleep, you're an insomniac?
Not really.
Is the patient feeling that way?
It's pretty subjective. People that feel that they're not getting enough sleep because they feel lousy in the daytime, because they feel unrested, for example, or because they spend a long time trying to fall asleep without success.
All right, I've got all those complaints. I come to see you. What are you going to do to me?
Well, I'm going to think about what might be the cause of the problem.
Okay.
I mean, it's a limited number of possibilities.
So what do we
that have to be considered?
What are the possible causes?
The first and foremost possibility is depression. Mm-hmm. Especially if the person is in their 30s or 40s, especially if the patient is female rather than male. But not necessarily. I mean, these are guidelines, they're not rules.
So in actuality, then, if somebody, since that's the majority or the first diagnosis, giving them a sleeping pill would be a bad thing to do?
Well, I don't know that it's bad, but it would be it's not the appropriate thing to do. The appropriate thing to do is to treat the depression appropriately. And that whether that means psychotherapy or whether it means an antidepressant medication or some combination of the two differs from person to person.
So, once you've ruled out depression, what would be the...
Well, once depression is ruled out, then we have to consider also another possibility, which is that the expectations of sleep, the amount of time that a person spends trying to sleep, may be inappropriate. And especially in older people, as we've mentioned earlier, whose need for sleep decreases to perhaps 6.5 hours a night, but you're still spending 7-8 hours in bed. So their expectations are unrealistic, and it's simply a matter of reducing their expectations. We have them keep a sleep log, which is a diary of sleep, their hours, when they go to bed, when they get up, and so on. And we can tell from that pretty much what the diagnosis is likely to be.
We're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about treating your insomnia. We'll also deal with sleepwalking and what are the appropriate tests for these disorders. Please stay with us. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm your host, Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm speaking with Dr. Charles Pollack, director of the Center for Sleep Medicine at New York Presbyterian Hospital and a professor of clinical neurology at Weill Medical College of Cornell University. When we left, we were talking about the disorder called insomnia, or difficulties with falling asleep. Dr. Pollack, you mentioned that depression is one of the first things that you try to rule out, one of the major causes. What are the other causes for insomnia?
Yeah, and the reason why it's the first is because it's the most common cause of chronic insomnia, and it's the cause of the most severe degrees of insomnia. Another possibility that I should mention is the restless leg syndrome, RLS, is a disorder in which people experience an uncomfortable feeling in their legs, which is often very difficult to describe. So it can't be very specific about the nature of this feeling, except that it's very uncomfortable, and it's associated with an urge to move their legs to the point that they sometimes have to get up out of bed and walk around, and then that will relieve the feeling, at least temporarily.
This is different than leg twitching while you're asleep.
Well, there's no disorder called leg twitching, but there are problems in which there are other kinds of movements or pains. There are muscle contractions that can occur during sleep.
But
this is a very specific disorder which tends to get worse as the day goes on. The people tend to be much more uncomfortable toward the end of the day, especially if they're trying to sit still in a theater, let's say, or in a conference or whatever, in an airplane.
And what do they feel?
This feeling, which is difficult to describe, and this urge to move their legs.
But it's not painful.
Sometimes people call it pain, but they say, you know, it's not exactly like any other kind of pain. But it is worse than any pain sometimes that they've ever experienced.
And this happens at night, and that's usually why they don't sleep?
Usually it's at night. Sometimes it reaches a peak at bedtime.
So what do you do about that?
And it's very well controlled with medication, which is a dopamine agonist, it's so-called. Medications that have been around for years for other purposes.
So trying to help a patient, hopefully there's somebody out here listening that hasn't been diagnosed, the things that they should feel is that their legs just feel like they have to move.
Right.
And it gets worse throughout the day?
Yeah, and it may not be present through most of the day. They may be fine until, you know, evening comes around.
And then it peaks at bedtime?
And then it peaks at bedtime, yeah.
Okay, and to the point that they can't lay down, they feel like they've got to get up and walk, huh?
Yeah, they lie down, but then they feel they have to get up and walk. And it may come and go. There are may have good days and bad days, you know, so it's not constant.
And in your experience, when they go to their primary care doctor, their internist with this complaint, is it diagnosed?
Now are recognizing it more because of television ads for a certain medication that we won't name, which is not the best medication actually available to treat this this disorder.
I ask this of everybody I interview. You know, of all the advertisements you see for medications on TV, do you think they truly are the best medications for the diseases you treat?
Now, in this case, no. The medication that is given the most airtime is not the one that I would recommend.
Let me ask you this. Are there things that you can do to make yourself sleep better that don't involve medication? And I'm thinking about diet.
Yes, maintaining a regular time for sleep, a regular bedtime. Most adults don't have a bedtime. If you ask them, what is your bedtime, they look at you as if you're slightly crazy, you know? Yeah, my kid has a bedtime, but I don't have a bedtime. But they should have a regular
bedtime. So a rhythm to life.
A rhythm, and that's, you see, the problem of, we were talking about earlier, of recovery sleep on the weekend. That problem comes about because people go to bed at various times, which are a matter of happenstance, a matter of what depends on what they're doing. If they're having an interesting session on the computer, they may go to bed much later. If, You know,
so I'm a victim of this. You know, at 10 o'clock at night, when I think I should be going to bed, yeah. I'm all of a sudden getting another lift, and right. I don't do it.
Right.
And if I did go to bed, I'd lay there.
You put it off.
I would toss and turn. What do I do?
The reason you're tossing and turning is precisely because of the unpredictability of your bedtime. You're not having a regular
discipline.
Time to get in bed, and the price you're paying is that you're getting up in the morning to begin the day at a particular time. In your case, you have to go to the OR, whatever it may be, and people that have salaried positions have to be at work at a particular time, which is often very early. Mm-hmm. And they truncate their sleep. They have a late night, but they have an early morning to get to work, and they wind up not getting enough sleep that night. And then the next night, they still may not go to bed early enough, even though they're sleepy from the night before.
So the best
and that
treatment.
Continues all week,
yeah.
And it gets worse and worse as the week wears on.
So the best treatment is just forcing yourself, just like the alarm goes off in the morning,
yeah.
The alarm should go off at night, it is bedtime.
Right.
And if we
right.
Now, how long does it take you to condition yourself? If I did this for a week...
Not long. I mean, it's not long. It's a matter of days.
Days. And then all of a sudden at 10 o'clock, I'd be tired.
You'd be tired.
What about exercise and sleep? Good, bad, irrelevant?
Exercise is great.
Does it help you sleep?
I encourage it.
Yeah.
Only not at bedtime.
Well, that's what I said to you.
Not shortly before bed.
Is there, quote, the endorphin kick after exercise?
I don't know about endorphins being important in this respect, but certainly exercise has a stimulant quality, you know, and it is a good way to make yourself feel more alert.
Now, on the flip side of it, personally, if I get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and go for a run, I feel a little more drained than if I go for a run at, say, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So is that just my biorhythm, or is there something to this?
I think that whatever it may be, if you make a regular habit of this, a few times a week, same pattern, you would find that sleep is much more predictable and much more solid.
So, again, the message being that we want regular exercise, not before bedtime, and force ourselves to get into that rhythm of sleep and
right.
being awake and working.
Right.
Let me ask you this just before we still have plenty of time left, but I want to make sure somebody who's curious about getting more information, are there websites out there that we can refer them to so they can get information?
Oh, yeah, there are several websites.
Like if you just type into the, go to Google and type in sleep disorders, well, something.
Yeah, sleep.
And most medical centers will have information on sleep disorders as well.
Well, you mean what kind of information?
Well, if a person just wants to find out more about what a sleep disorder is, what insomnia is, what sleep apnea is, where can they go read about this?
There are books, popular books that have been written about sleep problems, which you can find out about in any Walden Books.
Any Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, Barnes & Noble.
So you turn on Saturday Night Live or you watch an old Sid Caesar's thing and you always see somebody waking up and starting to walk around a dark room, the sleepwalking story.
Yes.
What is sleepwalking?
Well, that's what it is. I mean, it's an activation of wakefulness during the night.
So the person's awake?
It's not really wakefulness. I should say of movement. If it's a dissociated state in which a person is moving, usually there it can be something simple like sitting up in bed, or it can be more complicated. Children have been known to walk through several doors and unlock locks and so on. They do complicated things.
Can it be sometimes. Dangerous?
It can be if a person falls. People do have some visual perception during sleep. Even during sleepwalking, they can see what they're doing, but it's not as good as when they're awake, and they may have accidents. And I've seen several horrendous injuries as a result of sleepwalking.
You mentioned children. Is that the usual onset?
Well, the usual age is around 7 or 8 or 10. Usually, by the teen years, it's gone. But
so
sometimes
it's
it'll
self-limited.
Persist. Yeah, usually. Usually, sometimes it'll persist into teens or even the later into the 20s.
So if I brought you my 8-year-old child who was sleepwalking, what would you do about it?
Probably nothing, depending on how often it occurs and what threat it poses. I'd make sure that he's in a safe environment so that he can't walk out into the street, for example, in the midst of traffic, which has happened. So I'd want to be sure that he's safe. And it only happens occasionally, and that's the usual story, once every few weeks at the most. I'd probably do nothing about it, nothing beyond the safety issue. If it happens more often than that, then you may want to suppress the sleepwalking, and that can be done with medications.
One other thing that affects many of us is when we travel, say, from here to California, from here to Europe, or to the Middle East, and you get on that jet plane.
Jet lag.
What is jet lag?
Essentially, what you're doing when you travel across time zones is you're transporting the clock in your brain through to other time zones where the clock is telling the wrong time. So it may be telling you that it's time to go to bed just when it's time not to go to bed, etc. So people have a variety of symptoms which have in common the fact that they're trying to do things that are at the wrong time. They may have difficulty falling asleep, for example, or difficulty staying asleep, or they may be sleepy in the daytime when they're trying to be awake and alert.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other changes like in bowel habits and so on that can occur as well.
None of these things are bad. They're just part of the natural response to changing a time zone?
Yeah. I mean, that's the price you pay for trying to reset your clock to a time that is too far different.
So some people are pushing these things like melatonin or you should take an Ambien when you get on the plane.
Yeah.
What's your advice on that?
Yeah,
regard?
Well, it may be okay to do that. There is no really foolproof method of preventing jet lag except not to travel. But if you're going to travel across, and it's only travel, by the way, across time zones. So if you travel from New York to Caracas, Venezuela, for example, which is in the same time zone, mm-hmm. you're not going to have jet lag, even though the trip may take as long as any trip to Europe or to Hawaii.
And is there any truth to this? If you're flying across time zones, is better to fly east to west or west to east?
It's better to fly west to east than it is from east to west.
And why is that?
Because of the way in which the biological clock, the circadian clock, has to reset itself. It resets itself more easily when the time has to be delayed. The time, the new time, is represents a phase delay, so that the clock has to be set back.
So the best direction to fly then is from west to east, if you can do it.
Right. West to east, not east to west. Now, if you fly to Japan, you've got an interesting problem because that's exactly 12 hours out of phase. And so there is no rule about phase advance or phase delay that the clock...
If you do exact 12 hours, is it easier to tolerate?
It's very stressful, but it doesn't induce the same kind of phase change as a trip to Europe, for example, where Paris time is 6 hours earlier than our time, for example.
So tell me, how does a person get into being a sleep specialist? I mean, how did you get here?
Well, my interest in sleep actually developed as a result of my interest in coma. That was my original interest. And at my medical school, we didn't have a specialist in that area, but we did have a specialist in sleep. Mm-hmm. And so I became affiliated with this, Elliot Weitzman is his name, and we started learning about sleep, and then we started getting interested in the clinical problems of sleep, and eventually that developed into application of what we had learned about clinical problems to actual patients. So we actually developed the very first sleep disorder center way back when. Now, of course, there are hundreds.
And all of your patients are extremely happy with you, I'm sure.
I hope so.
Well, Dr. Pollack, it's been absolutely charming having this time to meet with you, and I hope that our listeners have learned about how much sleep they actually need, what to do if they have frequent awakenings during their sleep, and if they have trouble with breathing or snoring, and what are the signs and symptoms of insomnia, and what are the best ways to treat them. Dr. Pollack, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Philip Stieg is the chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College and neurosurgeon-in-chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Joe Woodruff is our producer. The executive producer is Alan Chartok. Our audio engineer is Adam Claremont. Production support for How to Save Your Life comes from the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. How to Save Your Life is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.